Did you go to Old Town Scottsdale and pick up some knickknacks, some tchotchkes?
I certainly did not, no.
You know, I went to Old Town Scottsdale one time, and it was full of tchotchkes.
For the express purpose, if I recall, of purchasing some, what was it, cactus-flavored margarita mix or something?
Well, actually, it was for the purchase of the purpose of purchasing something fun or exciting, and it wound up being Jason purchasing the prickly pear margarita mix. Which, if you haven't had a magenta drink before, this is the way to go about it, I think.
You know, they say magenta is not a color found in nature because it is the meeting of the two sides of the color spectrum.
All right. Well, that's fun. Good color talk.
Yeah.
We had some follow up about the home for sale from Mallory. Cauliflower Ziegler, who forwarded us some information about the Home Alone house from our last episode being sold. And it's a little sad that a piece of history is being sold, but it's kind of nice that it looks exactly the same, to be perfectly honest, from when they go back and do Home Alone 4, the Road to Perdition or whatever. You saw that.
That's a terrible title.
Yeah, you saw that. You saw that like fake movie poster of how they all look right now: Daniel Stern, Joe Pesci, and Macaulay Culkin.
It was genuinely horrifying.
Yes, it was. Oh my god! Just they ease up off whatever you're doing. Go on a juice cleanse or something. You don't look good.
Well, we could start with shaving and or just, you know, grabbing some of that Just for Men beard stuff, so it's not quite so patchy and gray and weird.
Yeah, so yeah, good job guys.
Do you think whoever bought the house like stages Home Alone reenactments with like the micro machines and the tripwires and what have you?
No, but if I own that house, do you know what I would do?
Stage reenactments.
Well, but a very specific one. Every Christmas season I would stage the fake mannequin party with the cast shadows and stuff. And I would just like have that go like for a couple hours. I mean, I would go somewhere else, like upstairs or something with some earphones on, so I don't have to actually hear it. But just for the neighbor kids to enjoy that.
Yeah. As opposed to decorating the outside of your house, that probably would be the best possible Christmas decoration you could put up.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like, hey, it's just like in that movie. And if some little punk ever came up and said, "What movie?" I would lose it. Kids
well,
these
you could,
days.
You could do the shadow puppets on the inside, and then just put the speaker outside, so the outside people can hear the music, so they can have the memories, and you can just go about your day reading the New Yorker and sipping tea or whatever it is you do.
I don't read the New Yorker. The New Yorker's for punks.
the Atlantic?
No, God, no. Why? Just Twitter. Just wonderful, wholesome Twitter.
I was trying to come up with a periodical that is
snobby.
As equally as discerning as your tea.
My tea's French. Okay, thank you very much. But moving on. Any other follow-up we have?
I have no idea. I didn't write anything else down. You did a workflow thing.
Ah, yes. Today, well, a couple days ago, the iOS app workflow. I don't know.
I think it's singular, isn't it?
Yeah, should be maybe. I could check on my phone right now, but I don't want to pick it up.
It's singular. I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, okay, good. Real time fact checking, listeners.
And it is currently singular, and it will eventually be AT&T. Heyo.
You're fired. So the app lets you basically like Automator or something on your Mac string up a bunch of commands to execute an order, and like it doesn't do anything in parallel or anything like that, and so I have it set up to mimic a Pythonista script that I had from a while ago, where it just takes the little fave star thing that I believe Matt Alexander, former guest, had popularized a couple years back.
Super fave.
Yes, the super fave. The exploding fireworks stars thing that says super fave in the middle. And what it did was it just does a simple text replacement on the little dark filled in stars and the little empty hollow stars. to replace those with whatever input you have. So if it's candy canes or whatever, or Christmas trees, or
candy canes, candy corns, what are the other food groups?
Yeah, they can't all be winners. But the that's just what all it does. It's just dumb text replacement stuff. And I said, go forth and annoy people. And a couple people so far have done that, but mostly just to me. So,
but now we can have it on our home screen where we're one button away from making ridiculous super faves.
Yeah, I was just hoping there would be more like splash damage. Like, go forth and
bathe the Twitter in super faves?
Yeah, sure, whatever.
But if everything's a super fave, is anything a fave?
Well, see, this is the thing. I'm hoping that it will spawn a new evolution of people modifying repetitive blocks of Unicode emoji stuff to do unique things, but keep repeating them.
So you want your super fave to follow evolution?
Yes. So it'll morph. Like, let's say, the staph virus. Staph bacteria. And so staph bacteria are now resistant to a lot of forms of antibacterial wipes and soaps and stuff. And so
that might be the worst metaphor I've ever heard in my entire life.
I'm just trying to make the world a better place.
Wait, okay, so your super fave script is going to get some of that black goop on it, and then a squid is going to come out, and the squid and the black goop are going to mix with a super fave and come out with Predator?
No. Dan, you're fired.
Mine was listeners, than yours.
Listeners, if you don't understand that reference, don't ever look it up. Never look it up. Ever look it up. You will be unhappy.
There's that handy infographic that explains how it all works.
It doesn't explain anything. It's stupid.
No, it doesn't. It just illustrates what happened.
No, it's stupid. Let's not talk about that anymore.
Listeners, so you're not totally lost in this past minute. Hasn't been a complete waste. We're talking about Prometheus. And that's all we're going to say because that movie was a disaster.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler that it was a disaster? I don't think that's a spoiler.
No, I meant that you described the metamorphosis process that occurs inside of the movie. So if someone was actually hoping to be surprised,
I don't think people are actually going to think that Predator is in the movie, because he's not.
No, it's not the thing that I meant. Okay, anyway, I hope people skip through this part. So moving on to the important stuff, I'm still using the Audio Technica ATR 2100 because Dan was happy. So that's good.
It's good. Are you any closer to it this time?
Yeah, I'm all up in its grill. So much grill.
So much grill.
All about the grill.
Now I'm hungry.
For what?
You said grill. Like, I want a hamburger or steak or something now.
Oh. I don't really like grilled hamburgers. I prefer the flat top hamburgers. The griddled ones.
Yeah, we have one of those little cast iron griddles that you set on top of the stove.
Oh, not the ones that not the fake grill pan things, right?
No, like an actual cast iron thing that covers two of the burners.
Oh, okay, good. Because I don't like the grill pan ones, because I don't really find that the marks that they leave are really that well worth it. Especially because they're a pain in the butt to clean.
What is that, like, fake meat hamburger thing that like has the pre-done grill marks that you can buy frozen at the grocery store? Have you seen the commercial for those?
Is it the Boca Burger or the Garden Burger? They both
Garden
might
Burger,
have it.
I think it is.
Yeah,
it's kind of like orangey colored, and it doesn't have any meat in it.
That's the orangey one is the Garden Burger.
but those grill marks—that's the—that's the mark of authenticity.
Yeah, delish.
I don't think we're going to be able to find a clean segue into the movie this week.
No, but what is that movie, Dan?
This week on Defocus, we're talking about 2003's Elf, directed by Jon Favreau, written by David Barenboim? Evidently?
Who cares about writers?
Well, this was the first thing he ever wrote, apparently.
Okay.
Which is impressive.
Yes. Well, wasn't it based on a children's book?
I have no idea, was it?
Wait, neither one of us did our research?
How could it be based on a children's book? Is it kind of like, it's just like a circle of a movie based on a book that then becomes based on a book?
Oh, the movie inspired a musical and an animated short, but seems the movie's original. Anyway, good reporting.
Yeah, you were just confusing the ending of the movie with the actual...
Yeah, sure, why not?
Real life?
Well, it just would have had some perfect symmetry, because then it was all real. let's see. The start of this movie is interesting for a variety of reasons. It is mixing some of the Christmas tropes of TV specials and films, chiefly the Rankin Bass stop motion stuff from the 60s that is quite prominently referenced, and homages are made.
You got the little puffin fella. You got was it a polar bear in there?
Leon the snowman.
Leon the snowman, of course.
Mm-hmm. And the narwhal, Mr. Narwhal.
I love Mr. Narwhal.
Bye, buddy. Hope you find your dad.
Thanks, Mr. Narwhal.
Yes, and all the little things. But it starts with Bob Newhart, adorable elf Bob Newhart, taking care of a small child who grows up to be man-child Will Ferrell. In one of Will Ferrell's many man-child movie roles, of which he is infamously renowned for at this point.
I love how in the beginning Bob Newhart is describing just the nature of elves and how there are three jobs, either making shoes, making cookies, or being one of Santa's elves.
Yeah, and the tree burns down. I love that.
Yeah, yes. It's irresponsible Keeblers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, it's just obviously not up to code. And... so we get the whole little spiel there, and we start to quickly understand that Buddy the Elf does not fit in. it is not subtle.
Just saying Buddy the Elf is hilarious.
Well, this is his name.
That's the name of his diaper.
He doesn't fit in, literally and figuratively, because he's literally not fitting anywhere inside of any of these little homes and houses and workshops or anything. Santa, played by Ed Asner, is also a novel casting choice. And
I thought he was great.
Yeah, I love Ed Asner in this role. If you had asked me to cast Santa Claus, I probably would not have gone to Ed Asner as my first choice, but
well, it's like going the opposite direction. Like, he's inherently so grumpy looking that he has to be like the perfect Santa.
Mm-hmm. And he is. And everyone is trying to be very nice to Buddy, but he's not getting it. He's not getting with the program. He's a human in an elf's world. much like the Ugly Duckling or every other similar tale. So he eventually finds out he's human and not an elf, which is a shock only to him. And then he decides he's going to go find his real father because Bob Newhart discloses this information to him, which seems dangerous given Buddy's development level relative to anyone. He's led a very sheltered life, and so he's not going to quickly adapt to other environments. And the little pep talk that Santa gives him about, you know,
the rules for New York.
Yeah, the rules for New York, which, well, I think is hilarious, should be a big red flag that he cannot cope with the environment that he's going to be walking into. And he does literally walk into this environment from the North Pole, past the sea of twirly, swirly gumdrops and the candy cane forest. And whatnot, until he gets to meet real raccoon animals and
I love the raccoon.
Yeah, and then sort of like crab walk through a tunnel to Manhattan. I don't know how he managed to miss the rest of civilization before then, but he did. And then we get all of the interesting stuff of him congratulating people on the world's greatest coffee, because they did it. They really did it. Congratulations to them. World's greatest cup of coffee. Way to go.
Has there ever been a more infantile role that anyone has ever played?
I'm struggling to think of anything. he cannot cope with this environment. That is not to say that he could never cope with this environment. It's just that he obviously does not understand where he is and what anyone is saying and the implications of anything he agrees to or rebuffs. So it's bad news for him, but it's a nice little fish out of water streak to his character, because it creates a lot of comedy when he gets hit by taxicabs and gets assimilated into the Christmas elves at Gimbel toy store. But before we get there, he does actually try to meet his father first, and he is confused for a Christmas gram, which I could make that mistake. Amy Sedaris makes that mistake. And Amy Sedaris, I must say, I love. She has a wonderful little line right before Buddy walks in about how she has to declaw 8 kittens.
that whole thing was just... she's on the phone with somebody who needs like a box of kittens taken care of. I hope that was just a hilarious ad lib and everyone behind the camera was just laughing and falling over.
Yeah. She's hilarious. And you know, she doesn't have a big part in this movie, but I love every little moment she's in because she brings a certain earnestness to her, secretary role, which is charming. And, she, of course, introduces Buddy to the father, James Caan, who's, well, the actor's Jewish, so it's also something. But he doesn't believe in Christmas, and he is staunchly against anything like the Christmas spirit, et cetera, et cetera. Very Scrooge-like. Our first hint of that is when he denies a nun books for the orphanage in, like, 1920s cartoon villain style. When he meets Buddy for the first time, he's not fully prepared for the shockwave that this is going to send through his life. And indeed it does. While Buddy is quickly removed from the office on this occasion, James Caan is unsettled by the revelation. That
I love that when he sings the song, James Caan just pipes it, goes, "That was weird," and walks away from him.
Yeah.
Like, it just has the most genuine reaction of just like, okay, I'm really uncomfortable now. I'm going to go sit down. And then the, should probably call security. And he pops his face and says, "I like to whisper too."
it's so silly. One of my gripes though with this movie is that James Caan oscillates from very realistic reactions to the situations he's in and very unrealistic reactions to the situations he's in. It's necessary in terms of the plot of the story for him to do this, but it seems like a wide swing whenever he does. So sure enough, he gets rid of him goes home for the night, and he's troubled by all of this, and he goes and he looks up the old stuff on his old girlfriend, sees the picture of Susan, etc. But he has a little bit of a soft spot here, which will come back to haunt him later. Buddy, meanwhile, is taken into the loving arms of Gimbel's, to be a Christmas elf for the department store, and it is great. The Gimbel's manager, who does not actually ever get a real name, but the actor is Faison Love. I feel kind of bad. I mean, he doesn't get an actual named part. Just Gimbel's manager. He gives it his all.
You call him Santa number two.
Well, actually three, because he's the third one we see. Very quickly, the third one we see, because the second one doesn't last long.
I love Artie Lang as the Santa, though.
Oh man,
you smell like beef and cheese or something.
Yes, you smell like beef and cheese. You sit on a throne of lies. But we're skipping ahead a little bit. So the manager pulls him up there. We get introduced to Zooey Deschanel, who's not really into Christmas and into the Christmas spirit as much as she is into a paycheck.
In the movie or as her character?
In the movie, I like to think that she didn't need to take this role on, but she does a good job.
Whose idea was it to dye her hair blonde? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. It's fine. Do you have a problem with it?
It's not fine. It's off-putting.
Okay, I'm sorry. I think her like ice pupil stare into your soul is off-putting, but that has nothing to do with her hair color.
A little bit of that, and she's not her. Especially in the introduction to her character, she's turned the quirky down to zero, and it's rather unusual if you're familiar with the rest of her work. It seems like her twin sister or something. It doesn't seem like Zooey Deschanel.
You're whining too much. So
I'm sorry, Jovi. Which is it just a really on the nose because she's so jovial?
I don't know. I didn't write it.
But she's the only one with this ridiculous name. Well, I guess Buddy is pretty ridiculous too. But maybe she got her name off a diaper too.
And Eugene, who's named Eugene. But anyway, so
I guess.
Yeah, we have the whole situation with that, and some misunderstandings unfold. Would you like to detail some misunderstandings that unfold?
Are you talking about his decoration of the store?
Well,
or are you talking about the creepy singing in the shower?
I was gonna say that one, but we can skip that if you want to.
No, it's fine. Well, since Buddy essentially has nowhere to go and apparently isn't troubled by that, He hangs out in the store all night and just makes awesome light bright and Lego art. And he found a lot of printer paper somewhere to make all of those snowflakes and whatever those little chains are. What are those called? Just paper chains?
I have no idea. I mean, it's just sort of like a paper garland.
Did you ever make those in school where you count down the days to Christmas?
I made them, but they weren't for purposes as much as they were just for keeping us busy. He makes up the whole interior of this because he's excited that Santa's going to be coming, because he knows him. He does a really good job, and it's sort of comical, because he's not good enough to be an elf, but he's way better at this than a human would be otherwise. So I feel the elves don't appreciate his talents and commitment to what he does here. And we get the super creepy scene in the shower with Baby It's Cold Outside, which I find to be an incredibly off-putting song. And I know a lot of other people find it to be a very disconcerting song as well. And other people are totally fine with it and think it's charming. I mean, Idina Menzel and what's his face?
Is that Michael Bublé?
Yeah, that's the one. They came out with a duet doing it for this Christmas season, which I've already heard on the radio once.
I really can't stay.
Baby, it's cold outside.
So it's obviously not something that is universally despised, but a lot of people think it's super disturbing when you pay really close attention to the lyrics of the song.
Well, Christmas is a time of innocence. You gotta look at it with the right eyes and give it the benefit of the doubt. That yeah. Doesn't sound right.
There must be something in someone's drink. Anyway, so to top off the creepy song, this is the creepy moment of him basically just hovering in the woman's locker room and her rightfully screaming about this.
Get out! Don't look at me! Get
out! Now, I think she's a little too forgiving of him later on about this. I personally, if anyone was just hovering around singing, would probably have reported that to somebody. So good for her for being so accepting of this one misguided person, but
it's New York. They have a different social standard for things.
Yeah, I guess. So
plus she's showering in a department store locker room, which I was unaware was a thing.
I didn't know they had showers, but I guess they need them or something in case Santa gets too sweaty. but anyway, we have those random scenes of Buddy like asleep in the window of the department store.
So
and James Caan walking by and Buddy waking up and like slamming on the window.
And when Buddy hits the window, I love that James Caan like actually jolts and steps back a moment because he actually seems genuinely terrified of the psychopath.
I'd be terrified even if it was even if I was an actor acting opposite of Will Ferrell and he slammed that glass, I would jump. It's Will Ferrell. You don't know what he's gonna do. He's crazy. And then we, of course, get the special present for your special someone, which is Lingerie? Again,
Will Ferrell just being like a 6'3" doesn't understand what the nature of this for someone special means. He's like, oh, well, my dad's special. I'll buy him this Santa-themed lingerie.
Yeah, well, he doesn't really understand the concept of lingerie. This is probably a good point to bring up the fact that he somehow walked from the North Pole to New York and has slept in his clothes. Wouldn't he smell to the high heavens and have like a beard or something? I mean, he didn't bring like a dop kit or something. So how is he taking care of anything?
I don't know about the beard, but considering his diet is essentially sugar, wouldn't his sweat just be sweet smelling?
I really did not put any thought into that.
Well, you brought it up. I've just figured we'd break it down.
All right. So gross. And
I'm just saying, if all you eat is maple syrup and candy canes, maybe you don't have the same pH balance into your sweat that the rest of us do.
Well, I mean, that didn't actually happen yet because he doesn't make breakfast until the following day.
Well, he had the syrup in his sleeve. Presumably, he would just take a nip off of that whenever he was in the mood.
Ah, right. Yes, yes. Whenever it struck him. So he tries to work things out, I guess. Wait, how did we wind up at the pediatrician office? I forget.
He gets arrested for fighting with Santa and needs somebody to bail him out, so he calls his dad.
Oh, that's right. Okay, so I missed the really important part.
Even though the Santa is the one who's chasing him down with a metal pole.
Yeah, I know. So Artie Lang.
Spectacular Artie Lang.
I'm not a huge fan, but he's perfect for this particular role. He is Santa, but he's not Santa, and Will Ferrell knows that he's not Santa, and he's quite upset by this and has no ability to deal with this information, because in his mindset, there's no reason why anyone would dress up as Santa.
Who the heck are you?
What are you talking about? I'm Santa Claus.
No, you're not.
Unless they were a liar. In fact, lies come into play in the accusation of sitting on a throne of lies, which is probably one of my favorite lines.
You disgust me. How can you live with yourself?
Just cool it, Zippy.
You sit on a throne of lies.
Look, I'm not kidding.
You're a fake.
I'm a fake?
Yes.
How'd you like to be dead?
Which I often repeat on occasion, when the mood strikes me. We get some lovely stuff here. Lovely little exchange with the two of them. The mall Santa is, of course, trying to do his mall Santa job up until the point where he breaks, which I don't think a mall Santa should do, really. They have a little bit of a fight, a little bit of a row, a fracas.
Perhaps the background check vetting for this particular venue was not as thorough as it should have been.
Yeah, of course not. It's Artie Lang. I mean,
well,
that should have been a red flag.
Artie's funny, even in spite of his issues.
Mm-hmm. All right, so the manager breaks it up, and Buddy goes to jail. Buddy gets bailed out by his dad. Who takes him to the pediatrician, who does the world's fastest paternity test, analyzing the DNA on the spot in the pediatrician's office, which I think is an enormous superpower.
First of all, he's a pediatrician, so why does he have this equipment back there? But yeah, it was pretty speedy.
Yeah, I say that because it literally would not have happened that way. Like, it's just no way. There's no pediatrician on earth that can do DNA sequencing in their office. It's not possible. But we
excuse it because it's hilarious that Buddy is eating cotton balls because he thinks they're fluffy little candy.
Well, except it has blood on it. But
just the one.
We get introduced to a charming child who I forget the name of. But she shows up several other times. And it's nice that they have that little callback in there because it's better than just having more random kids later on in the movie, which they do anyways, but that's just in addition to her. And they have that lovely little exchange about what she wants, the doll that she wants.
She wants a Susie Talks a lot.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, she may or may not wind up getting it. Spoiler alert.
This delightful Susie Talks a lot goes to this wonderful little girl while Will Ferrell eats a bloody cotton ball.
Yes. I guess you might need the iron back on his diet. But James Caan decides, well, since this magic paternity test says that I'm his dad, I'm going to have to actually take care of him. And he takes him home.
In spite of the fact that he's clearly over 18 years of age, he could just, you know, send him out on the street and send him packing and not really feel that bad about it. But sure, why not?
Or at least put him in a hotel so he's not actually in the same place as your family, which seems a little suspicious with somebody who's acting like this and who just got arrested.
Especially when you consider that they all think he's psychotic or has some sort of mental break.
Yeah. And so Mary Steenburgen is incredibly accepting of this, to a point that I find implausible, but good for her. She is a good sport in this movie. She plays along with all of this bananas stuff. And the kid Michael is, of course, too cool for stuff and things and people, but he really just wants his dad. Which is the heart of the his whole character arc thing. We get to see Buddy make breakfast, which is a charming maple spaghetti dish, covered in candy.
It probably wouldn't be so bad if he didn't leave the tomato sauce on that first round that he made for the mom.
I don't even know if that was tomato sauce or not. When I saw that, I was just like, is that just ketchup on top? Because it's just like this little red blob. But maybe it was. And I love when he has lunch to hand to...
It's a giant Ziploc bag. The gallon-sized Ziploc bag of spaghetti and maple syrup.
Yes. It's a good traveling food, I think. Like trail mix or something. Maple spaghetti. That's nice. That's great. Really good stuff. We get to experience some more things with the family in terms of, I don't know, I'm going to fast forward a little here. Snowball fights and...
Don't fast forward past the epic snowball fight because that's kind of ridiculous.
Okay, fine. Then talk about the epic snowball fight.
Using his skills as a substandard elf, he still manages to create, 100 snowballs in a matter of seconds and help Michael defeat the bullies that were throwing snowballs at them. And of course ends it with that long bomb, 150 yard throw at the end there to knock out the very last kid.
Yeah, which is nice.
I love that Mission Impossible style diving throw where he just narrowly misses the one ball that comes flying at him and he whips one around and hits the kid right in the face.
Yeah, that's nice. I like it. And of course, we start to get some of the backlash on decisions that our character Walter has made. Walter Hobbs, played by James Caan, with his I don't know, penny pinching attitude towards these books, where a book was printed without an actual conclusion to the book, and so he has to work overtime to come up with something satisfactory for. Fulton, the owner of the book company.
For a guy who supposedly spends all his time working and neglecting his kids, he's not super great at his job, is he?
Well, he's a penny pinching bureaucrat. So he can, you know, cut things, but he can't grow the company. Can't grow through cutting. But that's nice of him to slash budgets and take books away from orphans, but
I mean, it is the season of giving, so
mm-hmm. yes well he's super good at it, but this is where it comes back to bite him, with the boss saying no, this is not good enough, that you need to actually be able to deliver a decent book. We are introduced to the writers, Andy Richter and Kyle Gass,
which might be some of my favorite characters in the movie.
They are so clueless
Just utterly inept at their jobs. That they spend a couple hours brainstorming, and their best idea is to bring in a renowned writer.
Yes, but I love the way they sell him on it. He's like, this is what you bring to me. Like, you're my best writers. You're my crack team, and you're telling me to hire another writer. And they're so confident in it that they're just like on totally on board. They're like, yes, yeah, that's exactly why it's such a good idea.
It's just like every pitch meeting. They're talking with their hands. They're making dramatic pauses. Picture this. We bring in Miles Finch.
Yes. And Miles Finch is great because that is Peter Dinklage.
Spectacular role for Peter Dinklage.
Yes, yes. And this is, of course, in 2003, 10 years before he's like super mega ultra famous from Game of Thrones. But you know, he's always been a good actor. And he delivers everything for his part here. But before we meet him, we have some of the stuff with the mailroom.
The mailroom is phenomenal for a number of reasons. Do you have a particular favorite part of the mailroom?
I think it's that the guy next to Buddy is there on a work order,
work release from prison.
Work release, yes. I think that's. It's probably my favorite part.
I love that they get inadvertently drunk because the guy's putting like whiskey in his coffee or whatever. But my absolute favorite part is when they're like laying on the bins of packages or whatever, just talking as mindless drunk people do and saying absolutely nothing.
You're my best friend. That's it. You're my best friend.
You know, buddy, nobody around here listens to me. I got really good ideas.
I believe it. I know. I'm right. I listen to you. You have great ideas.
But I love how the work release guy goes like, man, I'm 26 years old. I got to get my stuff together. And he's literally like 48 years old looking. It's just he's so weathered and hilariously old looking. And I love that he says he's 26.
I'm 26 years old. I got nothing to show.
You're young. You're so young. My papa?
Yeah.
He didn't make Master Tinker until he was 490.
You're 490.
The tickle fight! Tickle fight!
And then they have a tickle fight.
it's quite funny. And of course, there's the whole thing with the dancing. And that James Caan needs to get down to the mailroom right away as he's trying to set up the very specific details for Miles Finch's limo.
must have an S500 black, yeah. Interior 71 degrees exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, props on the picking the Mercedes, which is, it's a nice vehicle.
I'm not a Mercedes guy.
I prefer it.
Okay.
To the other, the German luxury vehicles that we've spoken about.
Yeah, well, you live in a retirement community, so what are you going to do? that's a joke only Casey Liss would laugh at. And he's never going to listen to this episode because he probably hasn't seen Elf.
But the S500 is a gorgeous vehicle, better than anything BMW has on the market.
It's bulbous and weird. So the...
bulbous and weird. Anyway.
Uh-huh, yes. And so he just interrupts the call, but it's okay. He manages to get away from it just in time and go down and sort the situation out with Buddy in the mailroom, which is great.
He's doing a spectacular dancing. Everyone's happy. No work is getting done.
Yeah.
And we have the really awkward date with Jovi, where Michael, you know... Michael tells him that there's this unspoken code between adults about going to eat food together, which is essentially going on a date. But what did Buddy think that unspoken code actually meant?
I don't know. Maybe that it was cold outside and that someone really couldn't stay. They agree to go on this terrible, terrible date.
Where he basically just reenacts the ridiculous nonsense that he did the moment he landed in town, where, you know, drinking... the world's best, worst coffee,
mm-hmm.
Running around spinning in a revolving door. Mm-hmm. And, well, he didn't vomit this time.
Yeah.
He also didn't eat gum off of the railing outside the subway, which is probably a good idea if you're on a date.
Yes, for the best. Especially if it wasn't like mint gum, if it was just like bubble gum. And so that's great. She's fallen in love with this... psycho.
This 3-year-old who loves staring at shiny trees and ice skating and for some reason, all that's endearing to her.
Yeah. Good for her, I guess. And then...
he certainly embodies the Christmas spirit that she is lacking.
Yes, well, the best way to spread Christmas cheer is singing loud for all to hear.
Maybe it's the way it was shot or something, but there are two moments in the movie that, like, bother me on a filmmaking level. When they both look at the giant tree in Rockefeller Center, they do a close-up on both of their faces where they both go, wow. And then at the very end where she recites that little mantra to herself before she starts singing, those are the only two instances in the film where they get, like, really uncomfortably close with the camera angle. Did you notice that, or is that just me feeling awkward about that shot?
I don't like that, how that was shot or delivered. I think her delivery, especially of that line, is clunky.
The best way to spread Christmas cheer is singing loud for all to hear.
I mean, it's a clunky line to have to say out loud, because I'm not really sure I would ever articulate that particular thought. But it's not super important right now.
Just something about those two close-ups that bug me.
Yeah, and so now we get some more stuff where Miles Finch arrives, and Miles Finch is, of course, he's Peter Dinklage. He's not a super tall person, Buddy unfortunately wanders into this conference room.
It interrupts him in the midst of his children's book savant speech, where apparently he's just, I don't know, he's just the greatest writer who has ever graced the pages of children's books full of tomatoes and broccoli and peaches. And
well, see, this is the thing, is like, one of the things I really like here is when Andy Richter pitches the tomato on a farm, and Peter Dinklage immediately shoots that down as being too vulnerable. And then later on, when they find Peter Dinklage's journal, Andy Richter's first thing that he says is about the peach on a farm. He's like, what's more vulnerable than a peach?
And then the line I caught this time that I usually gloss over when I watch this movie is after he says tomatoes are too vulnerable, he says, everyone's pushing small town rural. The farm boat would just be white noise. It's like, what does that even mean? And why... Anyway, I love that their business is just breaking down the politics between these fruits and vegetables that live in various forms of cities and farms, and how that molds the children. And, cool. And of course, Kyle Gass is extremely extremely off-putting pitch of asparagus who are self-conscious about the smell of their pee.
Yes. It's a good pitch.
It's a wonder that he has a job at all.
Yeah. No, it's a crack team, really. But the... and there's this enormous misunderstanding between Buddy and Miles, where Buddy is incredibly insulting through no direct fault of his own. He doesn't know any better.
So on the cover above the title,
does Santa know that you left the workshop?
You know, we're all laughing our heads off.
Did you have to borrow a reindeer to get down here?
Buddy, go back to the basement.
Hey, Jackweed. I get more action in a week than you've had your entire life. I've got houses in LA, Paris, and Vail.
Oh.
Each one of them with a 70-inch plasma screen. So I suggest you wipe that stupid smile off your face before I come over there and smack it off. You feeling strong, my friend? Call me Elf one more time.
And so, Miles, good job, Miles. He bails on this because it's bullshit, really. I mean, I would bail on this because...
He doesn't need this. He's got houses in, what is it, New York, LA, and Vail, mm-hmm. all with a 70-inch plasma screen, mm-hmm. which I thought was a weird thing to brag about.
Yeah, well, and you know, women whenever he wants. I mean, it's good stuff for him. He really doesn't need this. And he already has the money.
He's really the right person to be molding today's youth.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really shitty situation for him to walk into, and so he walks out of it, and that's for the best.
Well, after, of course, kicking Will Ferrell's
Yes. Well, One can't simply walk out of a room without kicking Will Ferrell's out.
I love how he's choking him, and he says, you know, naturally, if he's in a fight, he says,
"Call me Elf one more time. Call me Elf.
You're an elf."
Of course, Buddy has no idea that he's being sarcastic. But
yeah. So awkward. And so that ends. And Walter is concerned because he has to still come up with something for his pitch, and now he doesn't have him, and they just have the journal, and they got to mock up something on storyboards. And he tells Buddy to hit the road, that he's ruined everything for the last time, get the hell out of here. And Buddy leaves, downtrodden over this whole thing.
He writes his very sad runaway letter on an Etch-a-Sketch, which was very eloquently drawn.
Yes, charming. And he gets out of his business clothes and back into his elf clothes, and he goes wandering through Central Park.
I love that in his letter he mentions that he accidentally left 11 cookies in the VCR. First of all, 2003, so why do they still have a VCR? But 11 cookies in the VCR?
I still had a VCR in 2003.
Did you really?
Yeah, well, because you would still own things that were on VHS from when you had bought them years before.
Yeah, I think that was probably the period where I probably owned a VCR, but it was thoroughly non-functional, and I just hadn't turned it on in 10 years to know that it was non-functional.
Oh, good investment. And so we run into Santa now.
Yeah, this watching it again here, did you feel that this was kind of like an odd turn for the movie where it was, sure, he's this ridiculous elf character, but he's like trying to meet his dad and become like a part of a family again, and then it's like, oh, we're gonna go back into silly Christmas story again?
Well, it's an odd turn that things piece together so perfectly that they have a crisis that involves Santa that needs solving, but it works in a certain way because it also validates Buddy being an elf or being associated with Santa.
And it was set up in the beginning of the movie where they talked about how the sleigh used to run on Christmas cheer and spirit, and now there just isn't any anymore, so they got to have the turbine.
Yeah. And this, you know, sets it up because this way James Caan and the family can see that Buddy actually isn't crazy, which is an important thing, really, in a certain way, to see that a character is not insane. But the whole thing transpires rather strangely, in that they need to really heighten the emotion of it by giving it some bad guys to work against. And for most of this movie, James Caan was kind of the bad guy. But we need to like James Caan, so James Caan can't be the bad guy. So then, who's supposed to be the bad guy? Oh, I know. It'll be the Central Park Rangers. The Nazgul.
The four horsemen of the Christmas apocalypse.
The Ringwraiths are here to chase Frodo through the Shire, and they do that. So
hey, I don't know what any of that means, because I don't know anything about Frodo.
Didn't you watch the first movie?
No. Part of it.
Get off this podcast.
I do love that when Zoe is watching the news, eating her bowl of presumably microwavable ramen with chopsticks, that the news footage they have of something that happened in the park is like the classic recreation of the Bigfoot footage, but it's Buddy wandering through the trees instead of Bigfoot.
Yeah, yeah, it was very intentional. The wide swinging gate. From when he's walking. But what I find so strange about that every time I watch it is the dismissive, angry, judgmental banter with the guy at the news desk against Charlotte, the news reporter on the scene. Like, this is what we call news reporting, Charlotte. It's just like, wow.
I must have missed really, that part.
It's really hostile. It's very anti-Charlotte. I don't understand why. So I don't like that guy.
Well, all Charlotte really wants is Tiffany Ring and for her boyfriend to quit dragging his feet.
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with that? And so we go through the whole thing. Everybody's pitching in to help versus the Central Park Rangers. And
I forgot to like build up the bad guys to discuss like their terrible, horrible past. Aside from the fact that we learned that they're on the naughty list, I love that the thing the news reporter cites is their questionable crowd control tactics used at the Simon and Garfunkel concert in 1985.
Yeah, yeah. Like that would still be under investigation in 2003. We go through the whole thing of like Christmas cheer is needed to get the sleigh off the ground. Michael comes up with a plan to show the list, the naughty nice list, of presents to, the news reporter to read off a couple names to stir up some sentiment, with listeners at home. And of course there's the Susie Talks a Lot. And there's the Biko Bar moment, which I always find to be hilarious. And
yes.
And,
did he want? Like a weekend at a spa or something?
Yes, yes. He's like, must have been a different, whatever the name was. And Charlotte, of course, with her desire to have a Tiffany engagement ring and for the boyfriend to stop dragging his feet. But this makes Charlotte turn off the cameras, which is the opposite of what he wanted, because it was about trying to get more attention for the situation so there'd be more Christmas spirit. So that a little bit backfired on him. Way to go there, kid. Good job, Michael. And Mary Steenburgen sees all this on the news and shows up on the scene, very concerned about her family, rightfully so, because who wouldn't be with that on the news? She kind of very quickly accepts the situation and gets swept up in it, and so does Zoe Deschanel, who also shows up on the scene. Neither one of them has seen Santa. Only Michael has seen Santa.
They know Buddy's there, and he's in trouble or something.
Yeah.
And it's Christmas Eve, so...
Yeah, and Zoe's only met Michael once before. And for some reason, she's totally on board with this. And she devises the whole plan of, you know, the best way to spread Christmas cheer is singing loud for all to hear, and... that awkward moment where she says it and then gets up on top of the little horse cart thing and starts belting out
carriage.
Yes, yes, on her carriage. And starts belting out stuff about like happy songs and crap. And then that's what stirs all the emotion for the peoples. And they cheer on, you know, and they sing along, and there's Christmas cheer enough for the sleigh to take off, and
because the cameras are back on, and everyone in all of these locations that we've seen throughout the movie are cut together in a montage of everyone singing, and the Christmas cheer peaks at 100 on the clausometer just before the turbine is knocked off of the sled by a large statue.
Yes, it was. Well, it's that little winged angel statue in Central Park, and so that gets knocked off and spirals away, but they still manage to fly. And they go on their merry way.
And then they have a happily ever after in like two different scenes where they have Christmas at James Caan's house, where if you look in the background, you can see Buddy receiving a giant like gallon jug of syrup for Christmas. Yes. Which I thought was quite hilarious.
Yes, I love that part.
It was kind of a growler. Do you think the North Pole has, like, at the North Pole gas stations, you can get a growler filled with maple syrup?
I'm not familiar with their customs or their ways.
It's a legitimate concern.
Okay. Well, I think it's something you could probably get done in Canada.
Canadian listeners, send us a tweet or something. Can you get a growler filled up with maple syrup at a gas station?
No, God. Oh my God! Just so much maple syrup. The thought of it just turns my stomach. I can't even like fathom anything that sweet. It's just revolting.
Are you not a fan of maple syrup?
I like maple syrup, but in like small normal doses. I don't like maple syrup in terms of like a giant jug.
Okay, on waffles, how do you syrup? Do you fill every little indentation on top of the waffle, or do you just sort of like haphazardly sprinkle a little bit on?
Fill every indentation on the waffle, because otherwise you don't have syrup on your waffle.
Okay, good.
Of course.
That's the correct answer. I'm just making sure.
Yeah, I know. But I don't then proceed to fill up the plate with maple syrup so that it's just floating like a raft in it. I don't use the maple syrup quantities that
you make like Buddy the waffle uses. The waffle and maple syrup equivalent of French onion soup.
Ugh.
It's just a bowl of syrup and a floating waffle on top, and you can melt some cheese on top or something.
And then you take your spoon and you crack through the waffle to the syrupy goodness on the inside.
Ugh. It'd also be great if it was searing hot, just like the soup.
Oh God! Ugh. Ugh. So yeah. Thanks, Dan. Thanks for that.
You're
welcome.
Horrifying
thought. So
I'm just spitballing ideas. Mm-hmm. We could potentially monetize the French onion soup. We need a name for it. We need a better name than French onion soup waffle syrup thing.
Wouldn't it just be maple waffle soup?
Yeah, I'm good with that. That's fine.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, I thought you were initially talking about needing to monetize our own brand of maple syrup.
There's a lot of competition in the maple syrup market. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure there's room for us.
Well, maybe we can get like a tax subsidy or something for our Canadian maple syrup production. But
genuine North Pole maple syrup?
Uh-huh. It's not, but yes.
Do they have maple trees in the North Pole?
No, because that's too cold. They just don't have trees up that far.
Hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with the Earth, but
I mean parts of it. Okay. I know I live in a desert, and I have for 30 years, but I like to think I know what the Earth is, at least shaped like.
Okay, well, there's a certain point where trees can't grow anymore because it's too cold.
Hmm.
Yes.
And you're saying that somewhere in or around the North Pole?
Might be further away than you think. Moving on, there's the second ending with Bob Newhart back in the North Pole, the adopted father. And Zoe Deschanel Jovi has decided that she's going to dress herself up as a pink Christmas elf.
I thought she was red.
I think she's pink, but she has a red belt and some red flourishes on her shoes and stuff. An accent color, if you will. But it's beside the point. It's a little strange. And they have the baby. And of course, there's the misunderstanding of, come to Papa. Then Will Ferrell actually sits on his lap again. Ah ha ha. The end.
Delightful movie.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like the Elf when it comes on every year?
Yes. Well, I mean, I never saw it until my sister bought it for me on a used DVD that she gave to me for Christmas. and she's like, you have to see this. And this must have been 2004, 2005, maybe she gave it to me. It must have been 2005 because it's a very used DVD. I watch the crap out of it. I love it. It's a seasonal masterpiece. It is uplifting. It is it's got childlike wonderment, but also some things to entertain adults. It is what someone might call a four quadrant movie.
I just realized we forgot the third ending where Walter goes on to open his own publishing company, and his first book is written by Buddy, basically telling the elf story.
Yes. With terrible art.
He should have
hired a different artist.
It's a children's book.
Like children don't deserve good art? What are you telling me?
I would never say such a provocative thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a world in which Elf could potentially be a fan fiction spinoff of The Godfather?
No.
I mean, I'm just saying, perhaps Sonny survived and had to go start a life anew, and that's why he's not super passionate about his job. This is just his witness protection cover?
No.
can't even entertain the idea.
Thought had never crossed my mind, not even once.
Buddy is the child from his previous life in the Corleone family.
Mm-mm.
And now he is under the witness protection program, but somehow he has been tracked down because that baby was picked up by Santa Claus. Do you think Santa really exists in the same universe as the Godfather?
No.
You're no fun.
Well, what do you think I was going to say? I mean, I'll entertain some other stuff, some other speculation, if you will. Is there some other possible thing you'd like to offer up?
No, that was really the first thing I saw, because James Caan is distinctly James Caan, even in this movie. And yeah. He'll never quite shed that tough guy persona that he has. And, you know, I just, for a moment, I imagined that, you know, he survived that horrific ambush, and Sonny ran off in the witness protection program. I mean, he's still in New York, so he didn't really hide very well, but, you know, hide in plain sight because there's a lot of people around.
You don't think he's U.S. Marshal Robert DeGaron from Eraser?
No, I would certainly hope not.
Okay, okay.
He's trying to assassinate random people when he's not selling books about puppies and elves.
With that magic gun.
That magic, wasn't that the gun from Quake? Doom? One of those?
I don't know if that was actually from anything.
It was the rail gun.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, or maybe potentially... he could have been another different character. You know, it's not a complete loss. I mean, he could be Paul Sheldon, a famous writer, who may have driven into a snowbank.
Now, is that pre-elf or post-elf? I kind of imagine that storyline is post-elf.
Oh, that is way pre-elf. Dan, that's 1990.
No, I'm just saying, in this mixed up fan fiction world that we're living in at the moment.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's still way pre-elf. Super way pre-elf.
I think it's kind of like more horrifying if you imagine it post-elf, wherein Buddy and his family are searching for him.
Mm-hmm. What if Buddy was Annie Wilkes' son?
Oh my god.
Isn't that messed up?
That might be the most horrifying proposition in this fan fiction that we're discussing.
Yes. Anyway, I don't think any of that is actually relevant to a thing. There's one thing I want to mention before the end of the show, which is we need to have some feedback from our listeners. Listeners, do you hear me? I am addressing you directly now, breaking the fourth wall. We would like you to please send us episodes and timestamps of your favorite moments of Defocused for our year in review that we will be conducting very, very shortly before to be released with the new year. So please, please take like 40 hours of your life and carefully consider all of the options placed before you, and send us your favorite moments. Send us things you think are funny or things that you think were entertaining or interesting. And then, you know, I'm sure some smart ass is going to send us like their worst moments, which is a possibility, I think, because you know they can't all be winners, not on this show anyway. and I'm fine with that. We can deal with that. We'll sort through some of the submissions. Please email Dan. I'm just kidding. Please don't email Dan, because that's actually kind of rude. But you can send him to us via Twitter, or you can email from the address on the show page, which is at defocus.co. Dan, where can people find the show notes?
Show notes for this week's episode can be found at defocus.co/27.
I thought you were going to fight me on that.
No. I tried it for real this time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I agree. We should encourage people to send in their favorite. I mean, and to be honest, 40 hours, it's really just like one work week. And everyone's got like the week off for Christmas, right? So, that's, you know, there you go. Just instead of going to your job, sit down for 8 hours a day and listen to our show.
Yeah, it's called a staycation, people.
Any other thoughts on Elf or general holiday related things before we close up shop for the year?
Yes, one thought. It is beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
You can't say that, neither can I, because you live in California and I live in Arizona.
But it's raining a little.
It's slightly gray here and in the mid-60s, but it doesn't look anything like Christmas.
Yeah, the mid-60s is kind of cold, though. Let's be real.
I personally, mid-60s is my favorite temperature, but it looks like fall. It doesn't look like Christmas to me, but anyway.
Mm-hmm. But it's still the most wonderful time of the year, wouldn't you say?
I would need some time with a third-party source to vet that properly, to get some independent opinion on it.
Would you say about 40 hours?
Maybe about 40 hours, yeah. I mean, okay. I'm pretty sure I could do it in a week. I mean, I could. Let's do a fixed bid for a week, and then I will email you for overages. Does that work?
I need you to relocate to Vancouver in order to do this.
My bid for vetting whether or not this is the most wonderful time of the year. We are going to get some sort of subsidy for that.
I'm assuming so. This is a film podcast
from the Maple Syrup Concern, at least, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We are terrible people.
I don't know what this podcast is about. Thank God it's over. The end. Ta-da!
The neighbors might think. Say, what's in this drink? I wish I knew how to break the spell.
I'll take your head, your hair.
I ought to say no, no, no.
Mind if I move in?
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurting my pride?
I really can't stay.
Baby, it's cold outside.
Cotton-headed ninny muggins?
Yes. You cotton-headed ninny mug. Ugh. You cotton-headed ninny muggins.
I did like the moment when they put him on testing the jack-in-the-boxes. Where he was just like cringing in anticipation for them to pop out.
I love at the end when the thing he's on the bag of toys and the thing that pops out of it is one of those jack-in-the-boxes. It's good stuff.